from hypnosis to photography, and some images that my next guest has taken are, in fact, quite mesmerising. Mel Burford is the only New Zealander to win a Pulitzer Prize for photography, and she's speaking and presenting the New Zealand Geographic's Photographer of the Year Award on October the 24th. And she joins me now on the line from Norway. Morena, good morning, Mel. How are you?
I am good, thank you.
Tell me, what are you doing in Norway? How long have you been there for?
That's a good question. I think it's coming up 5 years in March. So kind of over 4 years. We moved here. My husband is a cancer researcher, a very smart man, and he won a grant. And we were living in New York, I think, for 6 or 7 years. We had two small boys, and we thought raising two kids in New York versus coming to Norway. And the opportunity for Niels's career was incredible. And so it was a choice for family. It was a choice to come to a country that is similar to New Zealand in some ways. We have ferns in the backyard, which is good. So, yeah, it was a choice for family and to be in a smaller place. My guy's from Denmark, and so we're both from these small countries, and we just wanted to find a place where maybe our family could kind of be more rooted in a country that was similar to where we were both from.
What is Norway like, well, compared to New Zealand, apart from the ferns, of course?
I'm in Bergen, which is on the western coast of Norway, and it's actually quite a warmer climate because of the Gulf Stream, but it's the rainiest city in Europe.
Wow.
Which is saying something. And then my father was kind of telling me that Grandma supposedly rained more, but there was a debate on that. But but Bergen is this incredibly beautiful city. It's, I think the population's only 270,000, and it's kind of got this gorgeous harbour and houses scattered on hills, and it looks very reminiscent of Wellington. I mean, the only difference, I mean, the forests are the same. We don't have fjords. That's a little different, and it's a little bit colder. But apart from that, there's a lot of outdoors. There's a lot of cross-country skiing. There's a lot of people walking around with hiking pants on everywhere you go. And it's kind of, it's very New Zealand-esque in that way, where people love the outdoors and they're in it like every chance they can get.
Sounds fantastic. Gosh. Now, you're coming back to New Zealand, as I mentioned, on October the 24th. When was the last time you were here?
It was 10 years ago.
Wow.
It's crazy that it was so long, but my parents were both turning 70, and next year both my parents are turning 80. So hopefully I'll be able to come back again next year to celebrate with them. But I never meant for it to be this long, and it just happened, and I had to kind of battle through the homesickness, but it's been too long.
And are you bringing your children back with you?
No, it's a very quick trip. And I'm hoping that we can return next year and make it a family trip because they're in school and things are going on. So I'm just kind of coming back quickly to catch up with family. And then I've got a new job, so I need to come back and continue doing some work. So it's just a quick trip.
So you won the Pulitzer Prize in 2006, and we'll go into that a wee bit later. What are you doing now? Are you still in the photography business?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm always in my heart a photographer. That's where I learned to see. It's where I mean, picking up a camera was kind of ignited a passion in me that has never stopped. But I think what has happened over the years is that the media landscape has changed, the tools have changed, the demand for what you can produce as a storyteller has changed, whether it's video or can you be kind of doing Insta stories or can you catch up with social media. And so over the years, I've been getting more into film and producing and editing, and I also do a lot of teaching. So I think that you have to be able to learn and grow, and so the story dictates the tools that you use, or the client dictates the tools that you use. And so, yeah, I've got a bigger toolbox now. The camera is one of the tools, but I really enjoy playing with other ways of telling stories now.
And it is all about telling stories, you know, through photographs. But you didn't pick up a camera until you were 19. What drew you to photography in the first place?
Well, my father, he was a brilliant photographer. He still is, I should say, a brilliant photographer. He published books, landscape books on the West Coast, John Burford, well-known in Photographic Society of New Zealand. And he would go to the Photographic Society in Greymouth, where I'm from, and he would practice his slideshows on us, and we were in a lot of his photos. So as a kid, I just remembered my father taking photos of us all the time and us watching family slideshows with the old projector. You'd sit in the dark and hear the click of the tray going round. It was magical to me. And I think when I did pick up a camera, my father had already taught me how to see in a way just through watching his images. I can't take a landscape like my father. He does it in such a beautiful way. And of course, the West Coast is such a rugged, beautiful place to take images. I was very blessed with that I had somebody that I didn't know but was teaching me for so many years that would lead me into the job that I have now.
And back in those early days, what you say you can't take landscape photographs, I've seen the most incredible photographs on your website, and we'll give the details of that later. But in those early days, what did you focus on shooting?
Early days. Well, my first foray into photography was at the Christchurch Press, where the kind of photographers took me under their wing. And it wasn't so much what I was photographing, it was the fact that I was asking a million questions because I didn't know what I was doing, I think. And when I did work at the Ashburton and Guardian, we had faces in farming column. We had to go and photograph people on the street every day. We had a lot of rugby, as you do, and a lot of small community journalism. And for me, the beauty of it was just meeting people. The camera was just a gift because it gave me the permission to go and bounce up to people and say hello and start a conversation. So I think it wasn't so much in those early days about a specific topic versus the fact that I found this machine that could allow me to just dive into people's lives and be curious and ask questions.
And it's funny, you mentioned before how the landscape is changing, and we have Instagram, and I mean, everyone is a photographer now, really. Personally, I feel things are being lost in the art of photography and storytelling with so many different mediums. What are your thoughts?
I think that just because you have a hammer doesn't make you a carpenter. The gift of the new mobile phones and iPhones and the tools that we have, we're saturated with images. And therefore, if my students ask me, how do you make a difference with an image? I think photography is still an insanely powerful tool. I think it comes down to quality and being able to celebrate the everyday with beautiful images. And I really love that people are taking more images and are more visual with how they're seeing the world. And I think that Instagram is a place that people can celebrate what they see every day. But I think as far as impact, I mean, you think of 9/11, that there's images that are seared in our memory collectively forever. And I think that the power of that still image, no matter how saturated the world is with photographs, when you find these moments of in the world which it's the photograph that makes people stop, and it has a huge impact. I don't think that will ever change.
No, I recently saw the exhibition of 9/11 in New York. It was the most incredible and powerful thing I've seen in a very, very long time. For you, what are the most memorable photographic assignments that you've undertaken over the years?
That's a lot of assignments, but I love the elderly. I don't know why. Maybe it was because when I was first starting out in America, I didn't have any grandparents left, and I remember going to Central Otago as a kid. My mum would take us to my grandparents' farm in Miller's Flat in Central Otago, where my cousins are now running the farm, and that rural lifestyle. I loved small town America. I did a series on elderly cotton farmers. I love the richness of stories and the faces with wrinkles, and I don't know whether that's the New Zealand part of me. I like small everyday stories, and it reminds me of home. And I think that every person's own background dictates the type of stories that they love telling. Now that I'm a migrant here in Norway, I do more work with the migrant community. But I think wherever we are, I think when I first started in America, I was very homesick, and so I gravitated towards New Zealand-esque stories and tried to hang out with farmers in Texas. And I tried, actually, when I was there, I did a lot of Friday night football, and I once tried to convince a football coach that he should change his sport to rugby, and I don't think it went down very well. I was like, coach, you need half the players and you don't need padding. Our boys don't wear pads. But no, that didn't go down very well, so.
So in Bergen, you mentioned that you're working a lot with a migrant community. What are you doing?
Oh, there's several things. I have a production company and I'm producing and doing films mostly. I also started an education program, Silver Eye Project, where I've been working with migrant youth, and it's more a question of how do we make a home that we don't come from? How do we make a place our home? So it's looking at identity and belonging, and it's come from my own desire to work out if you come from one place and you live in another, then where do you belong? How do you navigate that and find a place? How do you define what home is? So I was very, very blessed that National Geographic Photo Camp sponsored three photo camps in Norway. And I was part of that project, which was just extraordinary. But we had students that were both Norwegian and migrant because the whole point was to get both cultures to talk to each other. And the camera, there's no religion, there's no culture, there's no language barrier with a camera. You don't have to be good at sports, you don't have to be from a certain place. The camera allows everybody to be able to visually share who they are. And I think that's especially when you're trying to help elevate people's voices in a way, or share something with people that don't have a common culture, but yet when they look at the photos of their families, even though they may eat different foods or listen to different music, it's all we're all the same. And so that whole process of using the photograph is a very, very powerful tool. And National Geographic Photo Camp have been doing it for years and years as a way of being able to bring people together. So it's been a gift for me to be able to kind of work with the migrant community, and they're teaching me how to find my own way, which has been a real gift.
I'm talking with Mal Burford, New Zealand's only Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer, on Sunday morning. Mal, what sort of reaction when you're working with these migrants in Norway? What sort of reaction are you getting from them? What is their feeling? Do they feel displaced, or is there a lot of community support around them?
I personally have struggled feeling displaced, and I don't think it's Norway. It's not the identity of one country, and of course there's some that have where you're integrated more, but I think when you're in a country where the language is not English or the language that you're from, and it's a different landscape than you're used to, then there's always going to be difficulty trying to turn that place into a home. I mean, even when I was in America, I struggled. It was big and kind of crazy. And so it's not so much the country, but I think it is difficult. You have to learn the language. A lot of these students didn't come with their family. They left by themselves and then tried to get work and then to bring the rest of their family here. Or the journeys that they've taken through the migrant crisis were just extraordinary. But no, there is support here, and they're finding their place, which is really wonderful to see. It's been a difficult journey for them, definitely. But Norway's a beautiful country, and they're finding work and they're at school and they're learning the language better than I am, actually. So, yeah.
What are the language barriers for you?
But I'm old. That's the language barrier. I've been to the university and I've taken Norwegian courses, and I went back this semester and I had to pull out because the homework was insane, and I had a new job and I just couldn't cope with all the homework. That sounds really lame. But
No, I get it.
our boys they speak Norwegian. I have a almost 5-year-old. Oscar's 5 next week. 5-year-old and an almost 7-year-old. So they're fluent at Norwegian at school, and we speak English at home. And then I try, but I'll go into a cafe and ask in Norwegian. I'll ask for a coffee. Can you have one cup of coffee? And they'll also say, they'll respond, would you like milk and sugar? I was like, come on. I think also Norwegians love speaking English, so I struggle with that. But it's a chip on my shoulder that I don't know the language, that I need to be better at communicating and pushing myself to really immerse in the language. So it's on my list of to do.
Mel, you won the Pulitzer Prize for Hurricane Katrina and your coverage of Hurricane Katrina. Tell me, going back to that time, and we're talking, what, 13 years ago now, does that still haunt you?
I think it's the different photographers on staff. It was an extraordinary effort from every member of the Dallas Morning News photo department and the photo editors and everybody that was involved. It was extraordinary. And I remember listening to the radio. I always listened to national radio when I was driving on my assignments, and I heard that the evacuees from the Superdome were coming into Dallas, and I rang the desk and I said, "They're coming." And they're like, "No, they're not." I was like, "No, no, put down the phone, listen to the radio, come back." And they rang me to get to Arena, which is where the Red Cross was setting up. And so I didn't go to New Orleans for the storm itself. I stayed and I documented the evacuees that were coming in on these busloads. And I remember this little girl climbing off the bus, and she just stood there and looked at me, and then she just peed on herself on the footpath. And I was just like, how, what have you gone through? Like, and the stories that came out of the Superdome were pretty horrific. I mean, even going back to New Orleans on the 1 year anniversary of the storm, still empty, and the people just, a lot of them didn't return. I photographed a church being deconsecrated. I never knew a church could, like, it was made a non-church. It was just turned from a church into a building because not enough congregants came back. So, but the good news was that I remember at Reunion Arena seeing, it was just a sea of kind of like black humanity. It was the largest black migration in American history. And there was this woman, white woman with her four white kids. Like, it was like, bing, what's going on? And I went up to her, Sue Sanford. I said, what are you doing? And she was like, I wanted to bring my kids. Like, her five-year-old daughter was in a ballet leotard with her little ballet stockings on. And this beautiful week, I was like, what are you doing here? And it was just chaotic. And it was right in the beginning. And it was just a mess. And she said, I wanted to bring my kids to show them that when people are in need, we need to step up and help. And I was like, uh-huh, what's your name and phone number? So it took me a while to get back to Sue, but then I followed Sue and her family for almost 2 years, and she took in a family of 20, not that day, but she became a volunteer with Red Cross, and then she asked to bring in a family, and she was a single mother of four that had a lot of resources, but then she took in the McRae family, who had a big family but no resources. And this family, these two families fell in love with each other. And being able to find that type of story amongst that type of devastation is the only way emotionally I can handle a story like that. I have to find somebody that stands up and says, let's change this, let's do something, let's help. And there are always people within the most horror of all horrors that always stand up, and they're little Florence Nightingales and Mother Teresa's. But it was a blessing, and I still remember being with that family and watching how they just gradually fell in love with each other, and to be part of that and to watch that, the beautiful humanity of it, gives me so much faith as a storyteller that you can keep going.
It's that, you know, yeah, the hope for humanity, finding those stories. Are you ever tempted to put down the camera? And I suppose in so many situations we see photographers out there in the line of fire and you know, terrible situations, and journalists. Have you ever been tempted to actually put the camera down and mark in and help?
Of course. Like during Katrina, we were handing out water and food, and you do have this boundary of ethics within journalism. And it was as long as you told the editor what was going on. But yes, it was something that of course humanity comes first. I remember doing the story on after the BP oil spill, and I was down there, and it was such a difficult story to get access to. And I remember meeting a Vietnamese family and going to their house, and they wanted to feed me and their four kids. And they talked about that they were hiring these shrimp boats to go out and help with the oil spill, but the Vietnamese community were being left out of the, I don't know exactly the details, but he couldn't get work. He was calling and calling, and his family couldn't get work. And then a couple of nights later, I was sitting beside the head of the Shrimping Association, shrimp boats, and I was just like, so how are families getting access? He said, he just has to call. I was like, well, I know somebody that can't. And then I knew at that point that if I went any further, then I could no longer tell the story of that family.
Right.
So I did, and he got work, and I gave this man this family's contact information. And I told the editor back in New York what was happening, and she said, we could have written it into the story, but in the end we decided to take the story in a different direction. But yes, for me, the fact that he had his kids to feed and he needed work, and the shrimping, it was all shut down. The Gulf was shut down during the oil spill. So you, when you make a decision, you realize that that story ends there, that part of the story.
I'm speaking with Mel Burford, who's coming back later this month to present the, she's living in Norway, to present the New Zealand Geographic Photography Awards. Now, Mel, tell me, what are you going to be speaking about?
I think for me, what's interesting about storytelling is the evolution of how we're changing as storytellers, especially from when I was at the Ashburton Guardian, we were in a dark room. So I'm old, but it's that kind of progression. Now there's social media and there's film and there's Insta stories and there's a constant demand, like how to tell the story, and there's audio gathering and editing and film work. And so it's coming from a place about finding your voice as well, and how you can evolve, because as you get older as a journalist, you change what you want to say, how you want to say it, like how you tell stories. So a big part for me was becoming a mother. I had to change who I was as a storyteller. So I think I'm talking about that kind of evolution of telling stories in a different way over the years.
Do you actually have the Pulitzer Prize, framed somewhere, or and do many people realise that you've actually won a Pulitzer Prize back home?
Back home. Well, and I don't talk about it. I don't actually. It's a little crystal, Tiffany crystal, wee thing, and it's sitting in an office, hidden way back in a shelf, because it's always this. I struggle with this, and I don't know whether it's a Kiwi thing, but I don't want to sound arrogant or look at me, or so I don't have really. I don't put my awards. It's not, yeah. I even struggle talking about it, because it's not, of course, it's a huge honor, but I was part of a very big team of people that did extraordinary work. So for me, I don't feel like it's mine. I just have a little symbol that we all share. So I don't know. I don't about it, and it's. I don't know. Does that sound strange? It's yeah.
No, it doesn't. It sounds typically Kiwi, actually.
Yeah, I don't. I hate this idea that people would think, because I'm no better than anybody. It's something that we did collectively, and of course, I think the best part about the Pulitzer was the fact that the story now lives on, so that hopefully that will never happen again, and it allows that the people of New Orleans and Louisiana and those images are now in an archive that will always be seen, and so their stories will be kind of stamped in history. And I think that's something that's really important.
Thank you so much for speaking with us this morning. I've learnt a lot, and I really hope your trip home goes well. Do you think you'll ever return to New Zealand to live and work at any stage?
I'm so far away from home. I don't think Norway, New Zealand, you can get any further actually on the globe. My heart and soul is still at home, and my boys have never been there, and it kind of breaks my heart in a way, because they're growing up in Norway and they were born in America, and I want them to know my country and my the family. And I mean, I have a few quite a few family members now in Brisbane, but I want them to know their heritage and where they're from. So I'm wanting to get them home more often. It's just when they're so young, it's difficult. It's 30 something hours of flying. So I'm not sure about whether I to live now when they're in school and they've just mastered the language. It would be cruel to say, all right, you've learnt the language, let's go. So we'll be here for a little while longer, but I would hope that one day I could definitely come back to that side of the world and maybe retire, or I would love to. I think New Zealand's such an extraordinarily beautiful place.
And we look forward to seeing you back home later this month. That was Mel Burford, New Zealand's only Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer. And she'll be back presenting New Zealand Geographic's Photographer of the Year Award on October the 24th. And we have just actually heard that National Geographic's Photo Camp is coming to New Zealand for the first time to do workshops. There are about five of them, and they begin in November, according to Mel. And they're doing them in collaboration with Air New Zealand, working with urban Māori youth.